This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, even if your original hometown doesn't even exist anymore, as we'll hear today, there are men and women around you who have done remarkable things for the sake of our freedom, and they have gone through things you and I have a hard time understanding or even imagining. And I think our eyes will be open today as we listen to the story of Dick Reiber, 93 years old, originally from the state of Georgia. He lives now in Kingsburg, California. In fact, if you ever stop by Valcommon Village, you'll have to say hi to Dick and his wife of 72 years, Lois. We're going to find out how they met. We're going to find out how he survived the Battle of the Bulge, because I'm not sure he thought he would for some really hairy moments there. But let's start early on. You grew up in a place that I guess isn't on the map anymore, Reeves, Georgia?
Actually, I was born in Reeves because my grandmother lived there at the time. Mother went home to have me.
All right.
Because her mother was a, sort of a midwife.
All right.
Didn't live there more than 6 months before we moved on.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, it was shortly after that that Dad moved to Kansas. Town name of Hoisington, Kansas. It's up in north central Kansas. At that time, Dad was working on the railroad.
All right. And you had a couple brothers and a sister, and Reiber's a German name. Your grandfather had come over from Stuttgart a generation before. What was your childhood like? What kinds of things did you guys do?
Yeah, going to school, and like I said, we moved to Kansas. We lived there about 4 years. My younger brother was born there. He was not quite 4 years younger than myself. Best part of 2 years later, we moved back to Florida because Dad's job in the railroad there in Hoisington played out. He used to be a boilermaker. That was the guy that got crawled inside of a steam locomotive and repaired all the tubes in there that generated the steam, the fire. So it was kind of a rough job.
I guess so. And all these folks who probably have followed Purdue University for years and wondered, what's that nickname, the Boilermaker? What does that all mean? You just explained it to them. You did them a favor. And this is during the Great Depression. So I'm sure that finding jobs was not easy for your father.
Correct.
What was it like growing up during the Depression? Because, you know, you hear a lot of talk about the economy these days and through recent years, but it seems like it can't hold a candle to what you folks went through back in the 30s.
I believe that.
What was the hardest thing for you?
That's very difficult to pin down something real hard. We just lived.
You didn't know any different.
We didn't know any different. That pins it down. We knew that we didn't have a lot of money all the time. In fact, I remember one high school year while we were still living near this town of Collegedale. The only pair of shoes I had to wear to work to school was an old pair of my mother's shoes that had an inch heel on them, but I wore them because they fit my feet.
Mm-hmm. And they made you look tall.
Then we moved around several other places. We moved up near Crossville, Tennessee for a few months, and then shortly after that, Dad moved to the West Coast, and Mother followed him. And in the meantime, she'd gotten me a job working in a hospital over on the edge of Kentucky, and due to the fact that I'd had a bad fall as a two-year-old, my nose was badly out of shape.
Hmm.
And so she got me into that hospital because she knew the head man over there from back in her school days down in Georgia. And he had some work done on my nose. They didn't get it perfect, but then the bone structure of the nose is awful difficult to rearrange perfectly.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, it looks pretty good at 93.
Well,
and the Germans almost blew it off your face, so yeah, I think it looks really good.
They got close, but I've got a couple of scars here on this arm too. That
we'll get to that. I want to get to that at the Battle of the Bulge. So you go to this hospital, you're working there, and they fix your nose for you. And what happened
then,
next?
Then folks arranged to get me back to from Tennessee, clear back to California, and the Los Angeles area in Glendale. in those days, to get cross country without paying the exorbitant fares that some people wanted to charge you for that, like buses and trains. There were drivers who would take you for a much smaller fee. They'd take a carload and drive across the country. And I recall sitting on my little suitcase in that car, traveling across the country till I got to Glendale. Well, Dad's job in the LA area played out because the job he had depended on a supply of cheap steel from Belgium and no more. So he had to go find the more work. He moved and went up to Oregon, west of Salem, and worked with my mother's brother, who was running a sawmill, small logging and sawmill operation up there.
All right.
I followed him. I hitchhiked out, and that's where the Army got me 6 or 9 months later. I remember that at the time, the thought of the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor. For a time there, I was going out on a night watch where we were keeping watch for the possible Japanese planes to attack Oregon.
So up in Oregon, I've heard a lot of folks from California, especially on the coast. And, of course, the Japanese sub did shell Santa Barbara, as folks may know. But San Francisco was on blackouts. L.A. was on blackouts. So you're up here in Oregon, and you're not even on the coast, right?
Well, we were only less than 100 miles from the coast.
Right.
Salem is not much over 100 miles from the coast, and we were 20 miles or so west of Salem.
So there was a concern that the Japanese would be bombing Oregon.
There was a concern that we should be able to keep track of any aircraft in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember being on a day shift, mostly at night, because they figured they would be a night shift.
So what would you do? Where'd you go?
I don't recall much about what we went to, but I do know that there would be two or three people to keep each other awake and be available to the phone. So if we heard an aircraft, anything sound like an aircraft, we could get on the phone to somebody in authority.
Was that kind of nerve-wracking work or not so much?
Well, after the first day, there were no airplanes. I never heard of an airplane while I was on duty there. I mean, planes were scarce then.
Sure, sure.
And no airlines going over every half hour.
Right. So it was a whole lot of hurry up and wait for nothing, huh?
A whole lot of hurry up and wait. But we didn't really regard it as nothing because we were doing what we thought they wanted done.
And you were getting paid for it?
No.
Oh, this is volunteer.
It was totally a volunteer.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if somebody else might have gotten paid for it, but I didn't.
Well, Uncle Sam would eventually be paying for you because he told you that you had to go to work for him after you turned 21 in August of 1942. What did that feel like to be drafted into the Army?
Actually, I was hadn't quite turned 21 when they took me in.
Oh, okay.
Went up to Fort Lewis.
Uh-huh.
I got outfitted, and then they said they were sending me down to Camp Roberts for basic training. The fall of 42, late summer and fall, I took basic training down in Camp Roberts.
Which is still there.
Which is still there.
In fact, they listen to this show every weekend over at Camp Roberts.
Something I didn't mention was I was pretty good at guessing the right answers.
All right.
Mechanically. So up at Fort Lewis, when they first took us in, then they always gave a bunch of paperwork.
Right.
And I blew the hell out of their mechanical aptitude test. Yeah. They told me I was way up above everybody else. Nothing came of it. They needed people carrying a gun worse than they needed mechanics then.
I guess so. And you heard about the paratroopers?
Well, I was taking basic. Mm-hmm. We heard about them several times. I thought, well, why not try for it? The thought of using a parachute didn't scare me.
Right.
So they shipped me down to Fort Benning. You have heard Fort Benning referred to before now?
I've talked to a lot of guys who trained there and had to go up those giant jump towers from the World's Fair, bet.
I was told that Fort Benning was where they trained all the infantry officers.
They did have OCS there, yeah.
And that they had a title for them then. Fort Benning idiots. Because there was so much about being a second lieutenant.
Right.
That you don't get just in a few weeks school. You got to get out there and live it a little while.
You're talking about the 90-day wonders?
Yeah. They said some polite way to say it was 90-day wonders.
And the impolite way was Fort Benning idiots.
Yeah.
Because they'd get out of OCS and thought they knew it all and then get into battle and find out they didn't? Is that the gist of it?
They didn't even make it to battle before they found that out. They got sent to a training unit. Uh-huh. But since some kind of bug bit me after I'd been down there a couple of weeks, I was in the hospital for about, best part of a week. So they said, maybe you're not for jump school. We'll send you to Fort Bragg where they're training the glider regiments. How about that? I said, it's all the same to me. It's still the same uniform.
It wasn't disappointing to you that you had gone to Fort Benning hoping to be a paratrooper and then got sick?
Not really. I did have one interesting experience there. This guy, he wasn't near as big as I am, but he was in charge of lecturing to us about a superior training that the paratroopers got.
Yeah.
There was a group over there. They were wearing fatigue uniforms with fabric officer bars on them. And I saw one of them smiling real big when the class instructor asked for volunteers. He got out there. I guess he thought he was pretty good at that hand-to-hand stuff. You know, that little guy about two-thirds his size seemed like just turned him every which way loose. He really demonstrated what he was talking about when he said that training made a superior fighter out of him.
Mm-hmm.
So I got sent over to Fort Bragg and eventually to Camp McCall in North Carolina.
So you're training with glider infantry now. It'd be a similar situation. You're taken in behind enemy lines, but instead of parachuting out of the plane, the idea is the glider's going to land you.
The idea was with the glider, yes. But they decided the mortality rate amongst gliders was just too high to attempt to use them in most combat situations. That some certain combat situations, yes, they might be useful, but the drop in from a parachute was better because you were a much smaller target. During the course of training at Fort Bragg, they eventually sent us up to South Dakota. Somebody had looked up the record and saw what I'd done to that mechanical aptitude test. They thought I'd make a good engineer.
All right.
I know now that part of my trouble is I've had sleep apnea all my life.
Huh.
And it interferes with learning when I'm sitting in a chair. So I flunked that after 3 months. But in the meantime, as a weekend activity, I discovered that the town of Madison, where they had sent me, Madison University.
So they'd sent you to the University of Wisconsin to train in engineering?
Yeah.
Okay.
I discovered that somebody had put up a tent out there over a floor and made a roller skating rink.
All right.
Well, I could more or less stand up on skates. I couldn't fancy skate at all. But I decided to go out there and enjoy it on a Saturday night. I'd get weekend passes because we didn't have any classes then.
Uh-huh.
That's where I met my wife.
Yeah, good thing you went over to that tent to roller skate. Tell me how you met her. What was that meeting like?
Well, actually, she and a friend of hers, Lois could stand up on skates pretty good.
Yeah.
But a friend of hers couldn't.
Uh-huh.
So I cut in. Here, I'm big shot. I'm going to have fun with this gal, teaching her, helping her learn to roller skate.
You're trying to help Lois's friend?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Going home that night, apparently the friend bragged so much about Dick this and Dick that that Lois decided she'd cut in and find out what happened. And she wound up 72 years later here.
So she saw the attention you paid this other friend. She said, I got to check this guy out. So then the next time at the roller rink, she cuts in on you? And
well, the next time, yeah.
What'd you think? What'd you think of her?
I decided I preferred her company to the other girl,
uh-huh.
And she seemed to like it. So before I got shipped out of there, we went down to City Hall and got a marriage license and got married.
How long after you met did you get married?
A little bit longer than a month, probably 6 weeks.
You met her, and 6 weeks later you were married?
Yeah.
There must have been something real special about her.
Well, I thought so at the time.
How do you feel about it now, 72 years later?
I'm still here.
Yes, you are.
Doesn't that kind of speak for itself?
And she's still here. And you didn't come back quite the same as you went over. So that speaks to her as well.
True.
So you get married, and then they ship you overseas?
No, actually, I went back and spent another 6 months, I guess, altogether. With the basic outfit I'd been with, the Glider Regiment. And a couple weeks later, they shipped me to England.
Was it hard? Did you get to say goodbye to Lois?
In a way, yes, because we just barely had gotten together again.
Mm-hmm.
She stayed around there a few days and then went back to Wisconsin because she had a regular job there. She was waitressing in Madison at the time.
Was it hard to go overseas and wonder if you'd ever see her again?
I don't remember it as being a really intense emotion, but it was there. It was a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What were you expecting when you went overseas?
I figured I'd be reassigned to some. I was not part of a company, you see.
Mm-hmm.
I was an assignee.
Right.
To be shipped in and blended into some other company there.
Well, we'll have to follow that part of the story when we come back. What was it that caused Dick Reiber to miss Operation Market Garden? How did he end up at the Battle of the Bulge? And, of course, we'll get to that moment that nearly ended his life. If you pull up Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook, you'll find a video of Dick explaining and pointing out the injuries for which he received the Purple Heart. We're going to jump right back into his story when Hometown Heroes continues after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the story of Purple Heart recipient Dick Reiber, 93 years old. He served with the 82nd Airborne during World War II. For the past 23 years, he's lived in Kingsburg, California, but he was born in Georgia and spent time all over the country as a young man as his father chased down work during the Great Depression. We've already heard about how he met his wife of 72 years now, Lois, while roller skating in Wisconsin, and all the twists and turns his military story had to take in order for him to meet his bride. They got married shortly before Dick headed overseas. And you had never, ever been on a ship before. But here you are, May 1944. You're headed across the Atlantic Ocean. That must have been quite an adventure for you.
It was. But oddly enough, being May, we never saw any kind of rough weather to speak of.
So you didn't get seasick?
No. Nearest I got seasick was later coming home.
So you get to England May of 44?
Yeah. We went into Scotland, into a Scottish port, and they shipped us down to Midland, England, down to near a town of Leicester. You spell that L-E-I-C-E-S-T-E-R.
Yeah. Looks Leicester. Like Leicester, but it's Leicester. Yeah.
Where I was for a few months, since I spent that month of August, I guess it was, with that sore on my tailbone, a big cyst that erupted. They put me in the base maintenance group. So I didn't go into combat when they made that fall drop around the Meijin.
Well, and before that, they made a jump into France on June 6th. Do you remember hearing about that? You're there in England?
I heard about it, but yeah. I was not part of the group.
Right, but was that a big deal to you to hear about this invasion and the gigantic force that was headed across the channel, or didn't make that big of an impression?
Well, I thought that we were doing, they were making some progress to get the situation under control.
Mm-hmm.
We were getting trainees in from various places into this group near Leicester, England,
mm-hmm.
that were going to be part of the rebuilding the glider regiments.
Glider regiments had gone over in the D-Day operation, and then in the fall of 44, Operation Market Garden up in Holland, there were more gliders that went in there. You would have gone if not for the tailbone situation. You had a cyst on your tailbone.
If I had been rated physical,
yeah,
but they were still had some pretty tender scar tissue.
So that operation didn't turn out too well. It was pretty disastrous. There were a lot of Americans and a lot of glider infantry that were killed up there in the Netherlands. So maybe that cyst on your tailbone saved your life?
It might have.
Yeah.
Because when I did get hit later in combat, there was an aid man there that got me under control and headed back in the chain of
Right. And we're going to get to that. I want to ask you a lot about that. So these two operations happen. You're not involved in any of those. You're still in England, and you're after you get out of the hospital, you're on this base maintenance crew. So you guys are just...
Well, we weren't doing much there.
Yeah.
They were bringing in some more trainees, but then they took the whole group and wiped that camp completely, as far as I can remember, and flew us over to France to an old army base. Old French army base. And we were assigned to rebuild the base as we could because the Germans had been there and they hadn't left it very nice.
So this is in Reims, France, and it was German-held territory that the Americans had captured, and now we're looking to build an operation out of there.
They were looking to build up a base
for
a unit to get it back in combat shape to go further. I remember standing on top of the old A-frame ladder that was something nailed together,
mm-hmm.
repairing light bulbs up in the ceiling of the place. Because I was willing to handle light bulbs, they'd assign me the job of fixing the electrical.
So you can answer that age-old question of how many soldiers does it take to change a light bulb?
I wasn't changing light bulbs. Actually, I was putting sockets in where the jerrys had ripped the light sockets out.
Oh, okay. So you were doing all the wiring.
I was rewiring light bulbs, sockets.
All right.
The night that we learned about the Battle of the Bulge beginning,
mm-hmm.
I was sitting in with a group of four or five other people playing a nickel poker game, and I had just gotten a big hand,
uh-huh.
and they told us to get busy and pack our bags, that we had to be ready to move out by midnight.
So you didn't get to play your big hand?
So I never collected. Best poker hand I ever had, and I never collected.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, they loaded us on some trucks, and we traveled for a day and a night, I think, to get up to the north side of the Battle of the Bulge. I was 101st. Airborne had already moved into the south side there.
So you're with the 82nd Airborne now.
Since I got over to England, I'd been assigned to the Company C, 82nd Airborne.
So you're arriving in Belgium.
So they got us up there somewhere they thought that was near where they wanted us. Why, they unloaded us and we got out and started walking. So.
And what did you see?
Countryside.
Did you see soldiers coming out as you were going in?
I never got close enough to see a German soldier.
No.
What I did see was Christmas Day. We were a little town somewhere in Belgium,
uh-huh.
and somebody started shooting machine guns at us from the woods up a long hill.
This is Christmas Day, 1944.
I think it was Christmas Day. We had the ground around there was frozen about 6 inches, four to six inches deep.
Yeah.
At that time, I had been transferred to carrying ammunition for a 60-millimeter mortar.
All right.
And it came in big cardboard tubes with a tape around it.
Right.
Well, you should have been able to grab a hold of the tape, and if you got it right, you could zip it off and take the tube apart.
Okay.
Some of the boys didn't seem to grasp the exact mechanics, or the tape was old.
Or frozen.
Or both. All three.
Yeah.
And they were just dumping those to one side because they couldn't get the cap off. I said, here, let me take care of that. And I got out my little pocket knife with a little short stubby blade that I use for that cutting things. Mm-hmm. And I'd zip on down through that tape and grab the end of it on the point of the blade and rip it off and had the ammunition ready. We heard this Jerry machine gunner up there, and we could hear the bullets going overhead. And the lead gunner for that mortar says, hold it a minute, I'm going to re-aim this. Entirely by sight or sound, I don't think he could see anything, but entirely by sound, I believe, he reset the aiming of it. You know, they lean it back and forth to
right.
aim it.
Yeah.
And then they take, on the tail end of it, there's charges, different charges. And they can take and leave most of them on if they want the project to go a long way.
Right.
Or they take most of them off if they just want to get it just barely in front of their people out in front of them. He reset the mortar, reset the charge on a shell. He dropped two shells down the barrel of that thing. You take it and drop it down. When it hits the bottom, it's like a shotgun shell in the bottom.
Right.
It hits a firing pin and it goes off. And he dropped two, waited a couple minutes. We never heard any more from that gunner.
Mm-hmm. So even blind to where that position
that
was.
That guy was a miracle. I mean, he was just had a touch for it.
That is impressive.
And I never did learn his name.
So that there's another situation where if he doesn't miraculously pull that off, you guys might have been sitting ducks for that German machine gun?
Yes.
You mentioned how frozen the ground was. Had you ever dealt with cold, like what you encountered there?
Not really. I had dealt with some cold up in South Dakota.
Right.
It gets cold up there.
But I bet you had better sleeping arrangements in South Dakota than at the Battle of the Bulge.
Quite a bit better.
Where'd you have to sleep at the Bulge?
In my foxhole.
How'd you dig a foxhole?
You went out and dug it for yourself.
Even through the ice?
It so happened that the few times I did dig a foxhole, we were back in the woods a little bit, back in brush, mm-hmm. and the ground doesn't freeze as hard back there.
All right.
And in fact, it was a few days later, we'd taken a good march for quite a few hours at night, and we'd gotten into this other area and dug in. And about that time, I saw this happen. And one of our armored groups came through this little town over there, following the road. They couldn't make any progress if they got off the road because of the ground being frozen partway, and there just enough so that they'd sink in and couldn't get out of it.
The tanks would get stuck.
They'd get stuck.
All right.
They got out just out by the edge of town, and a Jerry gunner, somebody over there, spotted him. He zeroed in. He'd already zeroed in on that area. Mm-hmm. So he knew just how to shoot his gun, and he knocked out the lead vehicle. Then he knocked out the last one that he could see in that line, and then he could pick the rest of them off to shoot himself. That was Hogan's Task Force 400. I don't think I'll ever forget that.
So you?
I saw that.
You were watching this, and it's just devastation. It's just sitting ducks.
Well, not like I would be a field around here, away from it. We were in the edge of a grove of small trees.
So just, we're talking 100, 200 yards, something like that.
It might have been a quarter of a mile.
Quarter of a mile.
Yeah.
But you're watching this, and there's nothing you can do about it.
No.
And Americans are getting killed left and right.
And we couldn't tell where the gunner was that was doing the shooting at them.
Mm-hmm.
But those 88s that they had were really a nasty piece of artillery.
How did you handle that? What did that do to you to see that?
I wasn't really getting a close-up, so it didn't penetrate quite as much as if I'd been closer. But just seeing those vehicles get shot. I couldn't tell whether there were people in them by the time the first one got hit, or they would have evacuated the vehicles. They'd gotten out of them because I knew they couldn't get away. And I never did hear how they did make out as a group, except that they had gotten pretty well shot up.
That can't make you feel too encouraged about your own future or prospects of getting out of there alive.
Well, funny thing, but I guess I just didn't have the emotional setup right that I would worry about it so much.
Maybe that's a good thing.
It either happened or it wouldn't happen. As I said, the next night we got to move to a different area, going out of a little village there. In fact, that's where I saw my first Volkswagen.
Oh, yeah?
In that little village. And there was a hill there. We climbed that hill. I was carrying machine gun ammunition for a 30 caliber light machine gun, and then.
All right.
And I got down in the snow and didn't get far enough down in the snow. I don't know whether if I'd had my face clear down in it, whether or not I'd been that shell fragment would have missed me completely or not. I don't think so.
Before we get more into that, let me take you back to Christmas Day. And I know you just said you didn't have the emotional makeup to think, oh, I might not make it and worry about all that. But on Christmas Day, when you're out there freezing your rear end off and the enemy's shooting at you, I imagine there had to be a moment where you thought, boy, it'd be nice to be back home in the States with my wife.
Yes.
And something tells me there's probably been a Christmas or two in the 70 years since that you've thought back to that Christmas.
There's been a few.
What do you think of when you think back to that Christmas?
I think that my life has been watched over.
Did you feel it then? When you were out there in combat, did you feel that God was looking out for you?
I felt it probably. It was beyond my worry, beyond my capability to do anything about personally at that moment. And for some reason or another, that worry just didn't get hold of me, and it didn't.
So now we're into January. It hasn't gotten any warmer. There's still snow everywhere and ice, and you're sleeping out in it. And on the 4th of January, as you said, you're carrying this machine gun ammunition.
Boxes, metal boxes with a belt of machine gun ammunition.
And had you guys been under fire before you got hit, or you didn't know this was coming?
We had moved several times. We went through this little village. They had us lined up along down below it, and then we were supposed to go up there because they thought somebody was up there to shoot at, I guess. The one that I was near, they all spread out. I mean, we weren't one every 50 feet around there.
Uh-huh.
And my machine gunner was up ahead of me, and I figured, well, in spite of that few Jerry shells going overhead, I saw two of them.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of that, if he didn't move out of there pretty quick, it'd be because he couldn't, and it'd be my turn to go play with the gun. Only thing was that Jerry was firing every 30 seconds, and the next one had my address on it. So here I was up on top of this hill.
Right.
A lot of bush over that to that side of me, valley down in front of me, more open land in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I was pretty bad hit afterward.
So you went to get down. You got to his position where his machine gun was.
No, I never saw him.
You were heading his way.
I was backing him up, waiting to see if he to get him some more ammunition.
Right.
He was supposed to call for another box of ammunition.
Because if you took too long, that may cost him his life. If there's too long of a pause between his firing, he becomes more vulnerable.
He does.
So you're waiting to get him this ammunition. They start shooting at you. You tried to get down?
What they were doing, there was no small arms fire there. They were throwing shells over.
88s.
Artillery shells over.
Uh-huh.
And they were going way over us.
Right.
Where I was. Unfortunately, they dropped one a lot closer.
So they're making the adjustment, and this 88 shell comes right in your area.
They can drop those right in front of the gun itself if they want to.
And in this case, they landed one right next to the guy trying to bring ammunition to the machine gunner. We have to catch our final break. But, you know, in some ways, it's pretty amazing that you're actually hearing from Mr. Reiber today. Not only the fact that he survived, but that he can talk and you can understand him after what the fragments of that German 88 shell did to his jaw 70 years ago. We'll hear it from the man who survived it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You hear a lot about World War II if you listen to Hometown Heroes, but have you ever wondered what it's like to be on a real World War II ship? The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of just two remaining operable Liberty ships, is docked at Pier 45 in San Francisco's famous Fisherman's Wharf. And the O'Brien is offering overnight programs on Fridays and Saturdays for kids ages 6 and up. Kids get to sleep on the ship in World War II bunks, have a private tour of the ship's galley, the crew quarters, guns and gun mounts, exhibits, and the crown jewel, the O'Brien's triple expansion steam engine. This is an experience like no other. For more details, call the SS Jeremiah O'Brien's office at 415-544-0100. That's 415-544-0100. Or visit the ship's website at ssjeremiahobrien.org.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Dick Reiber, our guest today. He's 93 years old now, but he was just 23 during the Battle of the Bulge, serving with the 82nd Airborne Division as an ammunition carrier. He was trying to deliver more rounds through the snow to his machine gunner when an enemy artillery shell ended the war for him. So, Dick, take us back, January 4th, 1945, to that snow-covered terrain of Belgium.
I was down on my knees and squatting way down.
But a shell hits. And pieces of it.
Apparently hit just close to me, too, because the angle that this scar was through is through my arm, and the angle that this hit me.
So it hits your right shoulder and the right side of your face.
It hit my arm right in here.
Yep, your bicep. Arm. Your right bicep and tricep and the right side of your face.
And the right side of my face.
What did that feel like?
Wasn't much feeling to it. It was just a big thunder. Boom.
I mean, it
big
feel like
noise.
Felt like Joe Louis slugging you in the face or something?
Well, I didn't really have any much feeling there. I didn't really have much feeling till later, till after it had...
Did it stun you? Did it knock you out?
I don't think it did, but I was only one round there for 75 or 100 feet.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have any idea of what else was.
So it hits you, and I'm sure at some point you realize how bad it is.
Well, after I spit that chunk of jawbone out, yes, I did.
So explain to us what it did to your jaw.
Actually, it took out a piece of the upper maxillary bone on the right side and opened a hole. I didn't know at the time, but later I found out it opened a hole into the right maxillary sinus. Then I also got a couple of holes through my upper arm here, which were not really serious.
And another piece of it, maybe an inch long, settled in the left side of your jaw.
No, it went in here.
On the right side.
And stopped here.
And stopped in your left jaw. Yep.
And it did crack the roof of my mouth. It separated the two bones that form the roof of your mouth there.
That sounds like a bloody mess.
Yeah.
Were you scared?
Maybe I did. I don't really recall the fear as such.
Did you think you were about to die?
I knew there was a good chance that I wouldn't find an aid man back there if I didn't get moving, but I could still walk, and I wondered a time or two how much worse that I would might have been injured if I hadn't been dressed for cold weather. I had on an undershirt, a knit undershirt, winter, a wool shirt, a sweater, a combat jacket, which is similar to what they use nowadays as a combat jacket, and a wool overcoat. And that went through all of that to hit me there.
Yeah. Well, and even with your face. I mean, if it's an inch up, your eyes are gone, or your nose is gone, or both, right?
I was just I don't know. I couldn't really say that it was, I felt shivery fear.
Right. Well, I'm just thinking now. I mean, how fortunate, not that I want to make light of anything you've gone through for 70 years, but how much worse it could have been. Or if you hadn't gotten down at all, maybe it takes out your midsection and you die there. But as it stands, your face is blown open. You've got a wound in your upper arm, and you're leaving a trail of blood in the snow because you can walk trying to find an aid man.
I found one, got back there, and I think he gave me some kind of a anesthetic shot.
Morphine or something?
I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
And next thing I remember is riding a stretcher that was anchored on the back of a Jeep.
So if you hadn't found a medic, who knows? You might have died out there in the snow, but they're able to get you back on this Jeep to a field hospital in Belgium.
They kept me there for, I think, a week or 10 days and did some minor trimming, I imagine. I know they did something in my mouth there, but they were very efficient with the anesthesia.
So you're pretty out of it most of the time. But at some point, they had to wire your jaw shut?
They did. The funny thing was, they put those rubber bands on there. 2 months later, after I got back to the hospital in England, somebody gave me a pair of little scissors to hang on a cord around my neck to cut that in case I got nauseated. 2 months later. Fortunately, I wasn't easily nauseated.
I guess so, if you never got seasick on the first transatlantic journey you had. But this is a lot to be dealing with, and here you're 23 years old, and your face has been blown half to bits, and your jaw's wired shut. How were your feelings about all of that?
Oddly enough, I hadn't really had a lot of it happened.
It didn't bother you that much?
Well, it didn't eat at me. Like, I understand that some of the people that got badly injured, it did eat at them. But for some reason or another, it just wasn't my turn.
Did you ever have a concern about what your wife was going to think of you now?
No. She was notified that I'd been injured, and I was able to tell her some little bit about it. Actually, it broke the hinge process on both sides of my jaw, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had a dental problem ever since. The VA does try to do for it. In fact, they just recently made me a new denture.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I can tell you're not a complainer. You're not asking for sympathy here. But you've had to deal with a lot for the last 70 years.
Well, it's a great laugh if you don't weaken. My problem is I was born weak. What's your excuse?
I know you're not looking to say woe is me and make us all feel sorry for you or anything, but this was a long, drawn-out process for you to recover from this injury. How many years were you recuperating in hospitals overseas and back home?
Well, I was injured in January of 45.
Right.
It was in March, I believe, when I finally went to work there in L.A.
March of what year?
47.
So more than 2 years.
They'd do a little adjustment, tissue rearrangement, get it started healing, and then send me home for a while. Well, at the time, in fact, when I knew I was about to be shipped over, I think it was up near Boston at the time, she said she was coming to see me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's when she got pregnant.
Aha. Uh-huh.
We had a son, but unfortunately, he developed the wrong kind of bug, and he only lived to be about 32.
But you're in the hospital, and you find out you're a dad.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. What was that like?
But, well, that was come near as being a shock to me as anything.
And that wasn't the only news that would catch you off guard while you were recovering. They moved you from a hospital in Belgium to one in England. And right before you came back to the States, April of 1945, you got some other news that would have all of America mourning.
I was in Bristol, England. They told me to go down for an early mess because I was on a liquid diet then because my teeth were wired shut.
Right.
And I got back to here on my bed with a few Christmas presents I'd been sent that had finally caught up with me. We were loaded aboard ship that afternoon.
Yeah.
The next day they told us Roosevelt died.
Wow. Another thing that I wonder. So this has been, I mean, January of 45, we're talking a little more than 70 years now since this happened to you.
Yes.
What's been the hardest thing to deal with, the most challenging impact on your life from that shell?
That's a hard one to answer. Sometimes it was just a case of putting one foot in front of the other, keeping going.
I'm sure there were days where that was hard, where maybe you didn't want to.
There have been days when I didn't want to get up.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What gave you hope when your face is blown half to bits and you don't know if it's ever going to be better? Where do you find that hope to keep going?
That's almost an unanswerable question.
Yeah?
I can't pin it down.
It's just there somewhere inside you?
I don't really know. I have thought about a few things like that when I didn't get to sleep in the hurry at night, but tomorrow is out there waiting to happen.
Mm-hmm. And it might just be better than today.
Keep going. Find out what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily that I think it's going to be any better or any worse. It will probably be a little different.
But it's worth finding out.
Pretty much.
All right. Well, before I forget, I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it because, you know, a lot of us can't understand the price that's been paid for our freedom unless we hear from someone like you.
Well, if you want a statement of fact, I consider that what little bit I actually contributed to the war wasn't enough to brag about.
That puts you in real good company.
I kept going, but it wasn't. I didn't wipe out an enemy regiment or even an enemy foxhole, far as I knew, but I kept going.
And what keeps you going now?
Probably just momentum.
That's great. I, you know, I've got to ask you, anyone that's been married 72 years has to have some wisdom to share with the rest of us who aspire to that kind of thing. What would you say is the secret to a long-lasting marriage?
First of all, learn that a disagreement is not a final answer. Any decision I make today is not a final answer. It's a direction for consideration for what to do tomorrow, that's all. And like I said, I never tried to make anything of it that I even came back alive because I didn't feel that I'd done all that much over there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did what they asked of you.
And the VA really pays me beautifully, too. They do.
Good. Should be that way. Well, when you consider the big picture, you were one of more than 16 million that went over there. And the war was won, and the enemy was defeated, and the horrors that enemy had committed were exposed and put a stop to. Does that give you some satisfaction?
Overall, we succeeded. Yes.
And do you think there's a lesson in any of that for us today? The way our world is now?
It's not a one-on-one comparison.
Very different world.
It's a different situation, yes.
Is there something, though, about America, then, that you think America could benefit from now?
America could be better. We had a problem there, and although in the process we, various people, made a lot of mistakes, we finally came to an answer. It's what we'll have to keep on doing. We'll make mistakes. But we're going to have an answer sooner or later.
You know, those are simple but really relevant words for the current state of our world. That is World War II veteran Dick Rybert, 93 years old. You can find a photo of him on hometownheroesradio.com. Also, of course, on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where there's also that video of Dick pointing out the spots on his face and on his arm where that shrapnel hit him 70 years ago. And thanks to the sponsorship support of EECU, Dick and his wife of 72 years, Lois, are going to receive CD copies of this program. EECU makes that possible for every veteran who appears on Hometown Heroes. Dick is also working on an application for Central Valley Honor Flight. And remember, wherever it is that you're listening today, there is an Honor Flight hub somewhere in your area. Volunteers who are hoping to make it possible for every World War II veteran who wants to visit the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., to have that opportunity free of charge. So go to honorflight.org to find that Honor Flight group near you. We're out of time on Hometown Heroes today. Thanks for spending this hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.